He concentrated on the dusty slivers of light squeezing through the slats of the closed blinds. After a while, the cats would come by to nudge her with damp, mossy thrusts of their noses, whiskers tickling her cheeks. There were two of them, both Siamese. They were all eyes and big funnel-shaped ears with intelligent triangular faces that made them look like B-movie aliens. It was calming, the way they kept the apartment constantly in motion, like a free-form mobile, prowling about randomly with their rolling muscular haunches and tall, wiry limbs. Aleatoric, she thought, like the music of chance. She liked to imagine they were thin, hungry fish. In the evenings, from the front of her apartment, she could hear the familiar sound of Simon's 10-speed bike clicking and whirring up the street like the fluttering wings of a giant mechanical insect. Then the clank of gears and soft thud of rubber against wood as he lifted it up over the railing and set it down on the front porch. This was her cue to get up off the living room floor. By the time Simon entered the apartment with the key she'd given him, she would be curled up on the couch, pretending to be immersed in a book. She sensed that Simon disapproved of her torpor and was unsure of what role he was being expected to assume. Ultimately, though, for Simon, a vegan of almost pathological proportions, any malaise could be cured with the proper combination of organic food and herbal supplements. Maybe you should supplement with an extra cup of soy milk was the sort of thing he liked to suggest, scrutinizing her pasty and listless demeanor as if she were a science project. I think we should try to boost your protein intake. When they first became lovers, she discovered that he surreptitiously tucked away vitamins into the front pockets of his jeans, chunky, smelly horse pill vitamins, which he would sneak off to take in the bathroom before falling asleep. She used to find this endearing. Simon was a graduate student in linguistics. He had a ponytail and long, sensitive toes that looked as if they were capable of doing independently clever things. Simon seemed to be perpetually attached to an olive-green Army-Navy surplus backpack which contained books, notepads, and a large shoebox. He filled the shoebox with color-coded note cards covered front and back, edge to edge, with his meticulously spiked handwriting. Simon was in the process of assembling his dissertation from these note cards. He did this all day long at his assigned Carol in the graduate library, and on the nights he spent alone at home in his own apartment. Sometimes, after they had dinner, he took out the shoebox so that he could fuss with his note cards. He whistled tunelessly and happily as he shuffled, reshuffled, and checkmarked them, occasionally selecting a few to stuff into his back pockets. She felt that he did this with a certain amount of self-satisfaction and maybe even smugness, but realized this might be unfair. Like Simon, she too had a dissertation that she was supposed to be working on. The title of her dissertation was Manic Depression is Romantic Aesthetic Impulse in the Music of Robert Schumann. It had been weeks, though, since she'd last met with her dissertation advisor, Professor Dragoremescu, who'd handed back the first chapter with a blinking, quizzical expression on her face. Dragoremescu, who was a lone woman faculty member in the musicology department, wrote cryptically brilliant articles devoted to the deconstruction of subversive ideological subtexts in French romantic opera. She was the sort of woman who could employ phrases such as formal alogicality or ideological interpolation without irony. Dragoremescu had a mother who was always phoning the office, causing Dragoremescu to lift up an apologetic index finger prior to embarking on yet another mysteriously elaborate discussion, which was held in Romanian for privacy. More and more, the constant interruptions came as a source of relief, though. And she passed the time by staring at the improbable presence of a stuffed armadillo which Dragoremescu, for unfathomable reasons, displayed on a small, elegant table in the corner of the office. Even when Dragoremescu was visibly annoyed, making tiny, rapid check marks around the borders of her desk calendar with precise little stabs of the pen, the Romanian syllables poured from her mouth, throaty, dense, and lush. like cream. She was well aware that her dissertation had taken a strange and not entirely appropriate turn toward the bizarre, but couldn't seem to stop herself from obsessing over certain inescapable details. The fact that Schumann had flung himself into the Rhine, for example, and had to be hauled back out like a large weeping fish. Whether or not his wife Clara had been having an affair with the significantly younger Johannes Brahms. The tiny F that had been inscribed in the bottom corner of his household diaries indicating each time he and Clara had sex. Why had no one come to visit him at the insane asylum in Endenich for over 7 years? What exactly was cupping? Why the leeches? The fact that after Schumann's death, the doctors at Endenich had immediately cut out his brain and weighed it. And which one of them had been the actual beloved? Had it been Clara, after all? Or had it really been Brahms? This is an unusual, highly imaginative approach, Dragoa Mescu had said, not unkindly. But perhaps you are letting your imagination get the best of you. On the nights that Simon stayed over, she lay awake and waited for his lightly sweating plane of inner thigh to grow heavy in sleep against her belly so that she could finally disentangle herself from him. She'd put on an old bathrobe, pour herself a glass of wine, and tiptoe barefoot onto the front porch, careful to keep the battered screen door from squeaking on its rusty hinges. There was an emergency pack of cigarettes hidden underneath the black lid of her petite hibachi grill. Simon disapproved and wasn't above throwing entire packs away when he found them inside the apartment. And she would sit on the weather-beaten porch swing, smoking. Even at night, the humidity pressed against her like a tangible presence, and in the absence of daytime traffic, the songs of crickets and tree frogs bloomed large and pulsated incessantly around her. She'd smoke and squint into the murky interior of her apartment, where the motley assortment of mismatched furniture cast bulky, elephantine shadows in the glow of the single-corner desk lamp. The apartment seemed unfamiliar to her this way, as if she were peering into the interior of someone else's life. There were nights when she sat and rocked on the porch swing until the birds began to pick up their quarrelsome rhetoric from the day before. And in the silky gray light, she could see the raccoons waddling off campus, sleepy and fat from pillaging the dumpsters behind the student union. One night, Simon woke up and came wandering down the hallway to look for her. He stopped and turned around in the empty living room, confused, then stood on one leg, sleepily using a long, skinny toe to scratch the back of his other calf. In the dim light of the desk lamp, his pale skin gave off a cool, blue, fluorescent glow, and the hollows above his collarbones and hip bones took on a sculpted, saintly air. The cats rubbed their faces and wrapped their tails about his legs, rippling in and out like cream-colored ribbons. Simon didn't know that she was outside smoking on the front porch, watching him through the window, and his body assumed the unembarrassed authority of someone who thought they were alone. He retrieved one of his moss-green terry-cloth ponytail holders from the coffee table and twisted his hair up into a dexterous topknot, then rummaged for something in the front pocket of his backpack. When he bent down with his back to her, she glimpsed a gingery tuft of hair forming a corona around his anus. He stood up and turned around and finally saw her on the porch swing. He realized that she had been watching him, and his penis grew heavy, ornate, and baroque, rising from its coppery nest of red curls to point at her like an accusing finger. As Simon told it, he'd stopped eating meat at the age of 10. He always recounted the story with a combination of relish and outrage. In fact, when under the influence of a couple beers, he'd been known to administer it like a coup d'etat to helpless colleagues innocently caught consuming hamburgers and hot dogs during departmental summer cookouts. As a boy, Simon had spent a week every July at his grandparents' farm in Indiana, where his family would gather for a yearly reunion. During one of these reunions, shortly before his 11th birthday, Simon had been invited to go frog gigging down at the pond with his grandfather and several of his older boy cousins. At first, Simon said, he'd been excited, happy to be included, and exhilarated by the adventure of going out in the middle of the night. Simon had been assigned the job of carrying the flashlight. His grandfather and cousins soon filled up their buckets with frogs they'd speared on the ends of their gigs like so many cocktail weenies on toothpicks. Afterwards, his grandfather had built a campfire, and while Simon and his cousins roasted marshmallows on sticks, his grandfather cut the legs off each frog one by one with a pair of meat shears, tossing what was left of the body into the fire. A number of the frogs were still alive, though, and Simon said they began to pull themselves out of the campfire, painstakingly dragging themselves out of the flames with their remaining front legs. They were making some kind of noise, is how Simon always concluded the story. I don't know what it meant, but there were sounds coming out of their mouths, and I could hear them. Shortly after she and Simon began seeing each other, they had quarreled when Simon insisted on ambushing some of her undergraduate music theory students and regaling them with this gruesome incident over a platter of chicken wings. She had taken him as her date to a post-lecture reception held at Dragoremescu's house. The next day, as a perverse gesture of reconciliation, he dropped by her apartment with a six-pack of Rolling Rock, takeout cartons of Szechuan string beans from the Happy Wok, and a tin of frog legs with a bow on it. After apologies were exchanged, they peeled back the curl of aluminum to peer at the source of their dissent inside the tin. In the end, they'd fed it to the cats, who instantly swarmed upon the gift, nosing the tin halfway across the kitchen floor as they alternately growled over, pawed, and devoured the glistening ivory flesh. She and Simon had now been together long enough that she'd become accustomed to the way he brandished this grisly frog tail, wielding it like some passive-aggressive social weapon when they were out in public. Although Simon liked to present it as a moral parable on the correctness of not eating meat, she believed that what he was really recounting was a story of how he became a linguist. In her version, the way that she told it to herself in her mind, she could hear the squish-suck sound of Simon's boots in the marsh surrounding the pond, feel the cool, steely weight of the flashlight and the schizophrenic zigzag of its beam glancing across the water. She could see how Simon, at 10, was bookish and shy, easily shocked, and she was touched by his innocence. She couldn't get past the incongruity of the marshmallows. Why the marshmallows? And she was mesmerized by the terrible beauty of the image of sizzling frog bodies inching their way toward Simon's marshmallow stick, their open, glowing mouths, and the fiery, indecipherable song they sang to him. On one of the nights when Simon was working on his dissertation, she went out to a club. She'd begun to do this frequently with a certain duplicitous pleasure. The band that was playing was called Smear. They were women, two of them former BFA students, with tattoos and dog collars, singing vehement punk rock songs about date rape and fellatio. She found this kind of music, with its numbing, frenetic drum beat and predictable clanging chord changes, soothing, especially in comparison to the uneasy and elaborately shifting harmonies of Schumann. His serpentine chromaticism, incessant key changes, morbidly recurring motifs and constant upsurges, downsurges, all that fussy waxing and waning had begun to make her feel queasy and anxious. In contrast, the band she came to hear at these grungy and smoke-filled clubs on the night Simon stayed at home were thrillingly loud and visceral. If nothing else, the sheer volume of noise made her feel as if she had been at least momentarily jarred out of her underwater stasis. At the club, she saw Miriam, the baker. She'd met Miriam at a similar club several months before when Miriam had inadvertently crushed her toe with a steel-toed boot in a crowded and jostling line outside the women's restroom. When her big toe had instantly swollen up like a prune, Miriam had been contrite and apologetic. Since then, whenever she stopped by the bakery where Miriam worked, Miriam always managed to slip her a loaf of free bread when the manager wasn't looking. As the weeks passed, the loaves so fresh they misted their plastic wrappers, had become increasingly elaborate and exotic. Oatmeal and wheat bread dotted with a plump sunflower seeds, a chewy white bread frilled with a delicate greenery of dill, a round loaf of Portuguese sweet bread with a glistening hard crust that looked as if it had been lacquered with several layers of shellac. After the show, Miriam invited her back to her efficiency apartment, where she uncorked a jug of cheap red wine and unrolled a sandwich baggie of gigantic pot buds like pressed green tumbleweeds, frosted with a sugary coating of crystals. The room was immediately filled with a heady scent of spice and mint. "I scored some Christmas tree pot," Miriam murmured with a shy smile. "I've been saving it for a special occasion." When Miriam wasn't working at the bakery, she wrote articles for the local alternative newspaper, and the floor of her apartment was littered with papers, books, and at least three manual typewriters. Miriam expertly used a pair of eyebrow tweezers to pluck off the potent red hairs, loading them into the bowl of a ceramic pipe. The pipe was in the shape of an anteater. In the dim flicker of candlelight, she found herself staring, after a while, at the sprinkling of freckles on one of Miriam's knees showing through a hole in her jeans. It seemed as if they began to bulge and swell one by one into fan-tailed goldfish. Then, with a swish and a twitch, they shimmied away. When she tried to reach out and cup one in her hands, it disappeared. This was when Miriam stood up and unbraided the thick red rope of her hair. The curls on the back of her neck were slightly damp with sweat, and she was smudged in flour and the warm smell of yeast. Miriam was freckled all over, like a quail's egg, ginger and cream, from the broad planes of her shoulders to the cool pink edge of her areolas, across the lush curve of her belly into the crease of her inner thigh. Her hands were strong from kneading dough. She tasted of cinnamon. Several days later, there was a tornado warning. All morning long, sinus pain circled her left eye with predatory intent. As the day wore on, the sky turned a queer mustard yellow, and by the time the tornado sirens began their mournful cry, her sinus headache had grown monstrous and turned into a migraine. She packed up the cats into their cat carriers and took them down into the cramped, tiny basement of her apartment. It was more of a crawl space, really, with a trap door that opened up with a squeaky rasp on the floor of her back porch. Cobwebs stuck to her face like spun sugar, and although somewhat cooler than the apartment, the basement was clammy, dank with a pungent smell of must. The cats, unhappy in the confines of their carriers, began to voice their discontent, and their howls mixed in eerie counterpoint with the circular wailing of the tornado sirens. The migraine came in relentless successions of glittering wave-like swirls, and she clutched her head as if it were a cracked egg, fighting down the nausea to keep the seizing yellow yolk of her brain from falling out of her mouth. She tried to keep her mind a neutral blank, because it hurt even more when she allowed her thoughts to tumble around in the circular swish and wash of pain like socks in a dryer. But she found herself haunted by images of Simon's frogs. Their moist and listless corpses seemed to crowd around her in the dank interior of the basement, and when the migraine opened yet another piercing sliver of light in her skull, it was as if someone had clicked a slide projector onto a new photo in a slideshow. She squinted into the brightness and saw herself, age 8, standing in the blinding summer light of her parents' backyard with a garden hose. She was surrounded by a circle of frogs. Brown frogs with creamy tan bellies and mossy green frogs with buttercup yellow stomachs. Plump, phlegmatic frogs with rolls of fat flesh dimpling at the creases of their arms and legs, and lean, gangly frogs with long, splayed toes. The frogs were all dead. Caught during a summer picnic, she'd been allowed to keep them as pets for a day in orange Sanka cans with plastic lids punctured for breathing holes. The next day, they were to be released back at the pond. Her father had insisted that they spend the night on the back porch, though, and by the next morning, sunlight had steeped them like tea bags inside the metal coffee cans. Their slick, limp bodies had burned her fingers as she'd laid them out on the lawn, checking for heartbeats and studying their slack mouths, cloudy eyes. She'd spent the next hour doggedly sprinkling them with cold water from the garden hose, hoping they might revive. Why hadn't she remembered this until now? Particularly with Simon and all of his strident frog activism. But then she remembered how she'd become so angry at her father, a gently and quietly puzzled math professor. How she'd refused to speak to him, but instead subjected him to the snitty, infuriating brand of silent treatment cultivated down to a snide fine art by 8-year-old girls. 2 days later, he was gone. Death by major appliance. She remembered the terrible crash, the delivery man's shout, and watching her father's eyes slowly film over, the line of his gaping mouth relax as he lay on the basement floor at the bottom of the stairs, crushed beneath the refrigerator he'd just purchased for the downstairs rec room. Her mother was at the supermarket. It had taken more than 10 full minutes for her father to lose consciousness under the weight of the refrigerator. When the EMTs arrived, they'd managed, with the help of the delivery man, to remove the refrigerator, then applied CPR and mouth-to-mouth to the body for over half an hour before her father had been declared legally dead. With a startling precision of detail, she saw the gracefully slanted scrip rising up like a silver welt from the avocado green of the new refrigerator. Frigidaire, she whispered to herself. Frigidaire. She had no idea how much time passed before she finally became aware that the tornado sirens were silent and that the sounds of wailing in the basement were emanating solely from the cats. She heard the muffled thump of a door shutting from above, then footsteps creaking across the hardwood floor over her head. She heard Simon call out her name. She heard him calling for the cats. She gingerly climbed up the rickety wooden stairs, awkwardly burdened by the flopping, rectangular weight of the cat carriers, being careful not to jar her painfully throbbing head. Outside the basement, the light was much too bright, even though the sky was still overcast. She let herself into the back door just as Simon reached the kitchen. She realized that she must look utterly macabre, smudged and clammy, smelling of mildew and covered in a thin veil of cobwebs. Simon immediately took in her painstakingly deliberate movements, the characteristic dark circles under her eyes. "Another migraine?" he asked. She squinted up at him and nodded her head. "Oh, honey," Simon says sympathetically, "that's just so sad." He was damp from rain, the hair at his temples starting to frizz slightly, and she could tell that he was boyishly excited by the storm. "The power went out at the library," he reported. "Did you see what a weird color the sky was?" She bent down to release the latches on the cat carriers, imagining that her head was a large Ming vase, infinitely delicate, infinitely expensive. She mustn't let the water inside begin to slosh around. She must be careful not to let it break open. As she straightened back up, though, there was a horrible swirl of pain followed by an overwhelming wave of nausea, and she stumbled around the corner into the bathroom where she vomited over and over again into the toilet until there was nothing left but dry heaves. Simon followed her into the bathroom. He stood over her and waited, and in between the sickness, he handed her a cold washcloth. His kindness sliced through her with a piercing silver clarity. She felt impaled by it, paralyzed and unable to breathe. She knew that in order to break through the surface of her silence, though, she would finally have to let go of the stony weight of all the secrets she kept hidden, even from herself. She would have to give the secrets away one by one. And even if it hurt him to have to hear them, the first ones would have to go to Simon. She would tell him about the frogs, about her father, about Schumann trying to drown himself in the Rhine and the dolorous gaze of Dragor Mescu's armadillo. She would have to tell him about Miriam and the compellingly lovely loaves of bread. She pulled herself up into a sitting position on the edge of the bathtub and rested her cheek against the cool ceramic tile. She cleared her throat. Her esophagus felt raw, her lungs on fire. "Listen to me, Simon," she would say. "I have something to tell you. Some of it will sound strange, and some of it you may not want to hear, but I need to tell you." But first, she tentatively took a deep breath, and then another, then one after another. And that was a real surprise, how easily it happened, the breathing. Thank you. I'm going to read three poems. This first poem is inspired by a traditional Japanese story, in fact, an animal bride myth. And in this particular story, I've written the poem in the voice of a woman who is a fish who can magically shape-shift into the form of a woman, which she does to express her gratitude for a fisherman who spared her life. As usually happens with animal bride myths, though, things run amok and don't turn out so well. This poem is called Fishwife. The sting of the hook in my lip, fluttering gills, and then the parched, awful burning as I was pulled up and torn through the roof of one life into another, where the lovely rainbow of my skin congealed to slime, while between thumb and forefinger you spread the webbing of my fins, measured my twisting weight in the palm of your hand, then dipped me back into the cool balm of my familiar realm to quiver for one moment of surprise, my tail unfurling before I darted away. But I had seen too much already, and so I returned to repay your kindness in the disguise of a woman with hands and feet and hair, a blue iridescent kimono. Let you take me for your wife. And for a while, you didn't seem to mind when I lunged at dragonflies or nibbled on the creamy vanilla edges of gardenias. Who can tell what makes a man become suspicious? I knew that you'd begun to spy when you refused to eat my soup, the one you used to think was so delicious. You hid in the rafters, watched me crumble bean paste, grind out a nutty fragrance from sesame seeds with a mortar and a pestle, cut out carrots into the shape of plum blossoms, lift my robes to urinate into the soup pot so you could have the best of my fresh brothy stock. Before I left, I gave you a lacquerware box so heavy you'd think it would be worth my weight in gold. I packed it full of earthworms and damselflies, bumblebee wings and gleaming coils of fine silk twine. Okay, now that's a monologue written in the voice of a mythological creature, but nonetheless, my English department forbids me from bringing soup to the potluck. I'm not sure what's up with that, but yeah. Well, it's true that I am obsessed with insects, and when one lives in a small northern exposure-esque town like Vermilion, South Dakota, it gets around that one is the crazy poet obsessed with insects. But the nice thing about that is then people start to bring you specimens, you know, which is kind of fun. My favorite specimens are collected by my friend John, who has a knack for finding cocoons of Cecropia moths, and he will wait until they're hatching and then bring them to me so I can set them free from my balcony. And if any of you have ever seen a Cecropia moth, they're just astonishing. They're about palm size, and they're beautiful burgundy color, and they look like they've been painted by hand. You can tell moths from butterflies because moths have the feathery antenna. And Cecropia moths find each other. They mate through locating. The male moth will locate the female moth by the pheromones that she emits. And the antenna are so sensitive that apparently if the pheromone were a teaspoon of dye randomly dropped into the Grand Canyon, a male Cecropia moth would know how to find it. And this seems like such an fascinating metaphor then for the terrible kind of yearning that one sometimes suffers from. So this is called Cecropia. To even try to describe the terrible voltage of those pheromones emitted in pulses, plagiarizing the human heartbeat's blank iambic a few hours before dawn, would be to fully understand raw need, desire's soft, dank underbelly. To think of it as merely perfume would be too pretty, a dilution, like using the word droplet when one meant ocean, or saying could when one meant must. Though sometimes I think perfume is all about just this lack, a faint Xerox, simulated mimicking of silk moth courtship practices, Calvin Klein models, thin puppets in a shadow play, because isn't desire what we desire to desire most of all? Just imagine how stunted our senses are when compared to the male Cecropia moth, who can feel the scented calling of female Cecropias from over a mile away, who if smell were sight and puffs of pheromone smoke signals could pick out a teaspoon of dye randomly dropped in the vast expanse of the Grand Canyon. His antenna hear the scent like drum beats, like the hot siren glitz of electricity sizzling the nervous system awake until the body is transformed into an incandescent singing hum that flies alight, weightless, without the burden of too much thinking. The Cecropias are hatching outside tonight. They awaken, stir, and unfurl themselves into the mild dark air through loose valves in their tough cocoons. Painstakingly, they inflate damp, crumpled wings into taut, bright kites tattooed in rich burgundies, browns, decorative scallops, eye spots, and red thumbnail crescents. In the dark, they find each other. Velvet bodies grapple, nocturnal and strange, but very gentle. Once, I lived in rooms with light switches to nowhere. Sometimes, I turned them on and off at night to see if anyone would answer. Shouts of surprised annoyance from the neighbors, maybe a soft knocking at my window. Once, I spent an entire summer sleeping with my front door unlocked, convinced that through sheer force of will, I could make him recognize this silent keening and come. All right, one final poem. This is called Octopus in the Freezer, and growing up in Laramie, Wyoming, where the winters were sometimes very severe, I remembered as a child waking up in the middle of the night because the sound of the furnace starting up would thump and clank and bump and wake me up. It would struggle because it was so cold. And I was always sort of an over-imaginative and sometimes paranoid child, and I assumed rather that it was a furnace that it was the octopus that my mother kept frozen in the freezer, bumping its head up against the freezer lid. And I'd forgotten about this until my very first winter in Vermilion, South Dakota, when around this time of year there was this enormous whiteout and lots of snow, and my back door was all frozen shut. And I woke up in the middle of the night in my little rental cottage in Vermilion, South Dakota, my first semester there, and the furnace was thumping and banging and clanking in the basement. And I thought, oh my God, it's that octopus again. And so I decided I needed to write a poem about that octopus, and this poem is actually addressed directly to that octopus. Octopus in the freezer. What could you possibly have been dreaming of as you slumbered coiled there, tentacles furled about your large, soft brow, bashful and pink, ruminating in the back corner beneath an arched shelf of antelope ribs, snugged between headless-bodied broods of sage-grouse, the icy bright pillows of sure-fine lima beans, and the buttered currency of carrot medallions? What were you thinking down there in my parents' basement? Blue blood's pulse stilled to a wiry tangle of navy ribbon, the syncopated bongo drum thump and thrum of your three hearts on break between sets and resting silent on the stage. By what unlikelihood were you frozen solid in this tightly wound pose, like a multi-limbed Hindu goddess in lotus position, riding the plains by freight truck to Sakura Square in Denver, where my mother admired the brawny circumference of your arms, the snow-white firmness of your inner flesh, the rubbery erect grip of your suction cups? And what were the odds that you'd be packed in dry ice by the oji-san behind the counter, tucked into our avocado green igloo ice cooler and driven home across the state line to Wyoming? You remain frozen in time in my parents' freezer, totemic, statuesque, infinite and apocryphal, even though you've been eaten many times over, one arm at a time, sliced thin into cross-section slivers for sushi on birthdays and holidays. As a child, I used to think the dull, muffled thud and clunk of the furnace firing into life at night was the sound of your head bumping up against the freezer lid, the cold grate and clash of meats shifting, scraping against one another in the wake of your thrashing tentacles, lash and whip. What error in judgment took you from your cozy niche, your eclectic garden arranged with such compulsive precision, the slender neck in lush-hipped wine bottles, the shiny winking bits of mirror startling back your placid, mild eye, the pickle jar whose lid you love to screw and unscrew, dangling in a tapered arm, your exquisitely sensitive ganglia rim suckers quivering to check for tasty things to eat? Did you become snarled in a fisherman's net, or clasped tight in the steel embrace of a lobster trap, caught in the careless kleptomania of your endless lust for crustacea? And did your chromatophore's pulse, first white, then red, to semaphore the blushing flush of fear flaming to anger? Were you caped in a smoky swirl of spewed blackness, dispersing the way Sumier ink curls away from the tornado whirl of a horsehair brush being twirled clean in water? Today, the snow just falls and falls, and I think of you as the relentless, volatile wind lifts the flakes into blinding, shimmering white veils that spiral and mist. So cold the fine spray delicately burns for one moment against the skin, and frozen, feathery etchings are flung up against the windows like splayed bits of goose down. Cars and trucks cough and come to a halt. My back door freezes shut. The barometer drops and empty wine bottles line the kitchen counter like bowling pins. How odd. I keep thinking to myself as everything around me creaks and groans and shivers, then stills to ice and frost. How odd that it has all come to this. And then I wish for someone, anyone at all, to dream of me, if only for a moment, to unfurl my rigid, aching limbs and melt down all my hearts, taste my salt on their tongue, let ice transubstantiate to breathing flesh and resurrect me back into the living again. Thank you very much.